Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 30589, Winfrey versus GGP Alamoana LLC. Arguing for petitioner Michael Green, also appearing for the petitioner Miles Briner and Glenn Uesugi. Arguing for respondent Thomas Benedict, also appearing for the respondent Patricia Napier and Kimberly Vossman. Argument on the merits.
Mr. Green and Mr. Benedict, are you ready to proceed this morning with your arguments? All right. Okay, and Mr. Green, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so when we get to the 10-minute point remaining in your opening argument, there'll be a yellow warning light will come on. Mr. Benedict will give you a warning light with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Please proceed, Mr. Green.
Chief Justice Reckonwald, good morning, Justices of the Court. Let me begin just by saying I thank you for the privilege of being able to argue this case, and obviously in the hopes that we'll give this young woman one day her day in court. What I would like to do is go directly to some of the comments in the ICA's summary disposition. There's about, I mean no disrespect to your brother. There's about six lines in this summary disposition that I agree with. What they say is the dispositive question is whether the person was responsible, was reasonably anticipated to be upon the premises. Here's what the summary disposition says in part on page 4. Although the term reasonableness is inherently ambiguous and summary judgment is usually inappropriate because the determination of someone's state of mind usually entails the drawing of factual inferences as to which reasonable minds may differ, reasonableness can constitute a question of law suitable for summary judgment when the facts are undisputed. And then they go through a series of conclusions that they say are undisputed, which is factually inaccurate. Now, as the court is no doubt aware, this case wasn't even set for trial, and discovery was ongoing. And one of the issues, obviously, before Your Honors, is whether or not there was a special relationship between Jasmine and the Alamoana employees in Alamoana Center, and if there was, whether there was a duty to aid and a duty to protect her, or simply whether or not, as the defendants claim, she was just a trespasser and had no business being on the roof. I think it's clear, and I hope you would agree, that she was a business invitee when she went to Alamoana Shopping Center. In Grosvenor, the court said that we have to look at these cases in the totality of the circumstances, case by case. This is what we have at Alamoana Center the day this young woman lost her life. We have a stairway by Bally's that is completely under the control of Alamoana. There are locks, there are alarms, and for one reason or another, the alarm system, the records seem to be in loss for this particular day. But there are locks that are and keys that are under the absolute control of Alamoana. There's an alarm system that leads to the roof. There's a heavy hatch that you have to open to get to the roof. If you look at some of the writings of the defendants in their brief, they suggest that she should have been with the Walenda family and been one of the great circus acts of all time because she was able to scale the wall of Alamoana buildings to get onto the roof. Employees who worked there in maintenance and security for 30 years have never seen anybody get in that roof unless they went by way of the stairway. These are the only two possibilities. Without even looking at it the light most favorable to the plaintiff and Appellant. Either somebody took her up there because the padlocks had to be unlocked. There's no way she gets to that roof. She gets through padlocks, she gets through an alarm, and she winds up on the roof. The other possibility is that maintenance and security, the only people that have the keys to the lock, someone left those locks unlocked. And this woman somehow wound up, and of course, the largest shopping center in the world, people are invited to travel throughout the shopping center. She somehow wound up on this roof, voluntarily went up there and wound up on the roof, but what happens? She's locked on the roof. If someone in maintenance or security comes to this area and sees that the locks are unlocked, common sense, reasonable inferences, like most favorable to the non-moving party, you think maybe they would contact security and say, is there someone on the roof? because the locks are unlocked. Maybe go up to the roof to see if there's somebody walking around up there, not just lock her on the roof, because she's locked on the roof. One of the issues is, number one, she's a business invitee. That's how she begins. They say she changed her status and became a trespasser. Well, if somebody took her up there, the question is whether she voluntarily became a trespasser. If this court believes that she was a trespasser because she shouldn't have been on the roof, then there are certain cases like Pickett we can talk about, where there's a duty to use reasonable care for the safety of all persons, reasonably anticipated to be on the premises, regardless of the status. Regardless. They say for humanitarian reasons, we forget about trespasser status. We forget about business invitee. We forget about licensee. They have a duty of reasonable care, of safety of all persons reasonably anticipated to be on the premises. Was she reasonably anticipated to be there? Why would Ala Moana put locks and alarms and swipe cards and video surveillance cameras if they didn't anticipate someone, one of their business invitees, may wind up going in that area? Certainly it was reasonably anticipated, where they wouldn't have had all those safeguards. Well, now she's up on the roof. And there's one thing I wanted to be clear about up front with the justices, if I may. If she doesn't have a special relationship, if there's no duty to render aid or to protect her once they find her up there, to me it makes no difference, because there's a causal connection argument. If there was a duty, if she was foreseeable to be there, if it was foreseeable, she winds up on the roof, there's a duty to use reasonable care for her safety, and then if she's injured, the trier of fact has the opportunity to determine whether or not there was a breach of the duty and damages that follow from that.
Mr. Green.
Your Honor.
Didn't Ala Moana say in response to an answer to an interrogatory that instead of it being locked, that Fry may have entered a fourth floor hallway near the Godiva store that led to a rooftop door which was propped open by air conditioning contractors and then traversed the rooftops to the Bali roof?
Well, they said that.
So isn't that a possible way she entered that area?
I think when you ask the question respectfully, someone should have the right to decide that. I don't think it's a matter of law. It's a question of whether there's a factual issue, whether there's reasonable inferences, and certainly what I suggest to the court, I do more than suggest, I argue to the court respectfully, that somebody took her up there. If they didn't, somebody left the locks unlocked, then somebody locked her on. The defendants can create anything they want to create. I only know for 30 years, their employees say no one's ever been on that roof other than going through the stairwell. So when we look at this, do we say as a matter of law they're right? As a matter of law we're right? I don't say that at all. I'm just saying somebody should have their day in court. Because even in the summary disposition, what they're talking about, it's undisputed that she was not authorized to be in the rooftop, and the rooftop was secured by a locked door and a locked gate. Who says that? It was locked when she was on the roof. And then when we talk about whether or not the court has a question of whether she voluntarily entered into this duct system, we have some evidence regarding the heat that was on that roof and whether she was suffering from hypothermia. One of the cases we have cited is Farrier case, where we talk about trespassers, whether they know of the trespasser or should know of the trespasser, where they're in control of the force. It's not comprehensible. First of all, this case is not comprehensible factually. We have a fire alarm that goes off in the food court. Ala Moana knows that the food court, the stoves, the ovens are connected to this duct system. We find a young, beautiful woman running around barefoot on the roof in a Padeo and sports bar yelling there's a baby stuck in the duct. A baby. They admit, the maintenance people admit to her confusion, her apparent confusion. They let her go, I shouldn't say that. She goes into the duct system that's connected to the ovens. You think someone might think to tell them to turn off the ovens? You think it's maybe a possibility when there was so much heat that caused a fire alarm? And if you accept with due respect the ICA's opinion and what the defendants say, they owe her no duty. Once she disappeared, according to them, they should have just walked away. You know what? She's in the duct system somewhere. Maybe someday she'll come out.
So, Mr. Green, you think the Ferrier case supports the duty in those circumstances, or what are your other theories for why there is a duty once they were aware she was on the roof and had gone into the duct? Focus on that part of the case.
I think that my position is that once you create the potential hazard, if it's reasonably foreseeable and someone is in danger, there has to be a duty to act. This is not barbaric ages where we just ignore that and let her disappear and she winds up over the oven screaming, I'm pregnant, please don't let me die, when the security people from Ala Moana say, in 5 minutes I get somebody here if they sprain your ankle, and they don't have emergency services there for an hour, and she's begging to be let out, and she's alive when they get there, and they finally turn off the stoves. This was not human. And frankly, I think a reasonable inference is that they were so terrified, they were so shocked about what happened, that no one could react. Well, that's not acceptable. One of the theories that we have, and I respectfully say to your honors, is, and I think it's clearly an issue of material fact, a genuine material fact. We know she's a business invitee when she enters on the property. Does she voluntarily change that status and become a trespasser? Well, frankly, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter based on Ferrier, because they see her up there. It doesn't matter based on Pickers. It doesn't matter. Whatever they call her. I'm aware of the fact we have no Good Samaritan rule in Hawaii. But that deals with third parties that come upon a scene where someone's being injured, and our courts say, you know what? You have no duty to summon medical care. You have no duty to summon police or help. Not where the party is in part responsible for the damages or injuries that are being caused to someone.
Mr. Green, I want to focus up this specifically on this argument, which is a little different from the Ferrier argument. So this would be appear to relate to the restatement of torts 314A. Talks about special relationships giving rise to duty to aid or protect. A possessor of land who holds it open to the public is under a similar duty, which is a duty to use reasonable care to members of the public who enter in response to his invitation. Now, I understand your theory is she was a business invitee because she came into Ala Moana Center. That's the inference would be that she entered Ala Moana Center as a business invitee. Is it your position that even though she went into a non-public area of the center to which she wasn't invited, that this duty, this special relationship duty, would still extend to her? And if so, what would the authority be for that position?
I would like to be able to argue that. 12 people from this community, whether she voluntarily and knowingly changed her status by going to some place where she wasn't invited vis-a-vis the rooftop, whether someone took her there, where she's a business invitee and she winds up getting on the roof where someone is planning on coming back and getting her, because it's my position, I think it's reasonable to argue, and I think it's a genuine issue of material fact, how those locks got unlocked. There's a reason there's locks there. There's padlocks. How did she get up there? Someone either left them undone or someone unlocked them and took them up there. So I don't say she voluntarily changed the position from a business invitee to a trespasser. I think that's still a subject to argument, and I think it's a genuine issue of material fact.
Mr. Green, once the people at Ala Moana Center knew that the decedent entered the exhaust system, was there a basis for a duty that we can say might have arisen at that point?
You know, one of the things that I attempted to do, maybe not so successfully in deposition, was to suggest that once she entered and disappeared, whatever they considered her to be, i.e. a trespasser, now there's clearly a safety issue. And the answers I was getting was, well, you know, we need more facts, Mr. Green. Well, she's disappeared. You don't think it's a safety issue yet? Well, we're not sure. How about when she's banging on the ventilation system? Let me out so I don't die, I'm pregnant. If our courts are prepared to say to the people of this state that the rule of law will be that when you find someone who you say is a trespasser, and we know the cases that I've already suggested, and now she's in a position of death or great bodily harm, you know what? Go back down the stairs, lock the hatch, and hope she turns up somewhere.
Mr. Green, did you bring this up as part of your petition for writ of certiorari?
Yeah, I think my memory is that inferentially through the cases we cited, that it was brought up. But I have to say that it doesn't matter to me. I was, in due respect to Justice Acoba, I wanted to answer the question, but in our theory of the case, it doesn't matter whether they acted or didn't act when she was there. My issue to try this case is whether or not they used the exercise of their duty of reasonable care for the safety of she and other people, if she's reasonably anticipated to be up there, or anyone is, and I say the system of safety suggests they were concerned about it, forget about the duty of whether they're supposed to render aid, whether there's a special relationship, whether they're supposed to protect. When she dies, some trier of fact has the right to know whether there's causation between whether she was reasonably anticipated, whether they breached that duty, and as a result of the breach of that duty, this kid lost her life. Now, I would hope that at some point in the near future, we take a position regarding something. I don't suspect this court is going to change the Good Samaritan rule, but once she's reasonably anticipated to be there, there certainly is a question whether there's still a special relationship. I'm convinced of that, and I think it's a genuine issue of material fact whether somebody got her up there. But at some point, when you see somebody in grave danger, imminent danger of great harm or death, to ignore it, knowing what the consequences are. They have complete control over those stoves, complete control over those ducts, to say there's no duty to do anything. If that's the status of the law in this state, respectfully, I would hope you change. That's not what this state is about. That's not what humanness is about, not what humanity is about.
Mr.
But
Green,
I don't need
the,
that.
The center argues that the Good Samaritan law would encompass this situation, so that the center would only be liable if there's gross negligence or wanton act. And so what's your position with respect to that?
Again, I would like to argue gross negligence or wanton act at a trial, but this is not a Good Samaritan issue as far as I'm concerned. This is not a third party coming upon something. They're one of the causes of this. Alamoana Center is an active participant in facts and a sequence of events that led to the death of this youngster. There's certainly in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And I the briefs clearly say that the ICA flipped the rules of evidence basically on their head and decided that in the light most favorable to the moving party, they've discussed these facts and have rendered this judgment in favor of.
Mr. Green, basically, if Alamoana does in fact have the duty as the landowner to protect and guard against unreasonable risk, all right, or warn against that, and they're basically required to take reasonable steps, correct?
Yes.
All right, in this particular instance, though, it's clear that no one knows how she got up on that roof, correct?
Well, no one knows for sure, but that's why we have circumstantial evidence. That's
right.
Why we have reasonable inferences, and at this stage,
but provided that Alamoana takes steps that are reasonable, and you would agree that some of the steps that they took to secure that area by way of a secured gate, a secured hatch, having protocols in place to prevent people from accessing the roof, those are all reasonable steps, are they not?
They are, and it shows a foreseeability mm-hmm. of people who are invited to Alamoana perhaps getting to that area. Now what we're faced with, whether these locks in fact locked, how come the printout for the alarm system disappeared for this day? But did someone take her up there? When the Chief Justice had asked, or one of the other justices had asked me about the fact that the other side says it was it was Justice McKenna. The other side says she scaled the wall. Well, somebody should be able to listen. We should have some people from the community to listen to the 30 years of experience that no one's ever gotten up there before, except through the stairway. And then they lock her there. She's in custody. She is in their custody. She could never have locked those locks from the roof. Never. And as I said, the inference in this case, we're entitled to what the law says, clearly, in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. This case cries out, and I don't mean to be dramatic, this is not a summary judgment case. There are facts in dispute, there have always been facts in dispute, and respectfully to your brethren, because they say these are certain facts not in dispute, doesn't make it so. And that yellow light goes on, I can't remember what it means, but I'm going to sit down.
It means you have 10 minutes left in your argument. You can continue now or can save it for rebuttal. It's up to you.
I'm done, unless you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Green. Mr. Bennett, your argument.
Please, the court. My name is Tom Benedict, and I'm happy today to be representing the people of Ala Moana who came to Ms. Fry's aid in a very difficult, unusual, and bizarre circumstance, one which the plaintiffs in this case seem to think we should have been able to anticipate how everything would have turned out. That's not the case. And what I will show you by going through the records, if need be, is that everything that Ala Moana did was reasonable under the circumstances. But before we get there, we need to talk about duty. We need to talk about whether or not a duty is recognized in this case. As the court is well aware, the issue of duty is one of law, one for the court to decide. Mr. Green, when the justices asked him whether or not he could cite any authority for the existence of a duty for different aspects of his argument, what I wrote down was, well, I want to argue to the jury. I want to get to this. I want to tell the jury the story and see what they say. Mr. Green has not come forward with any authority establishing a duty under the circumstances of this very unique case. And that's something that I think needs to be borne in mind as the court evaluates the situation. No one would dispute that this was an unfortunate and tragic incident. And we have great sympathy for the Winfrey family and for Jasmine Fry as well. But there is a very unique set of circumstances here which, as best as we could find in Hawaii law, we've never had to look at before. So let's take a look at what I call the premises liability duty. And the way I think about premises liability duty is perhaps a little bit different than what Judge Trader referenced. But what I think about it is that a landowner has an obligation to, with respect to people reasonably anticipated to be on the premises, to keep the property free of conditions that may pose an unreasonable risk of harm. We put together our case law, that's what it says. The trigger, clearly, is the person has to be not reasonably anticipated to be on the property. What we take from the fact that this area was locked off by both a gate, and by the way, let me just explain just a little bit.
What about your answer to interrogatory where you say that the fourth floor hallway near the Godiva store that led to a rooftop door was propped open by air conditioning contractors on that day?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll address that. If what you're asking me is whether or not we should have reasonably anticipated that she would get to the roof, I have two answers to that. The rooftops are at different levels and different locations. The rooftop referenced in that answer to interrogatory is essentially sort of on the other side of the fourth floor. It's not the rooftop that we're talking about.
Okay.
In what the plaintiffs have put into record or into the evidence here is that we've never had someone scale our roofs or breach into our roofs. Each rooftop is locked in the same way for the most part. A gate, a lock, some kind of alarm system. So they're done individually. We've never had a situation where we thought possibly someone got in from some area that was open and then people came over. So I would again submit that with respect to the Bali rooftop, which was locked upon Mr. Oshiro's entrance, that was still an area not reasonably anticipated to find this from.
Mr. Benedict.
Yes.
Once the decedent was on the roof and the center employees were present and she climbed into the duct, at that point, or was there a duty on the part of Ala Moana to do something about that, to prevent harm to the decedent?
You know, I think the answer is there's no recognized duty in Hawaii law for that. And the basis for that position is that the Pickard duty doesn't apply. That has to do with the hazardous condition on the land itself that the owner is responsible for.
Would Pickard apply at that point?
I don't believe it does. And it is an interesting question, Your Honor, because from our point of view, again, we've never had anyone go into the ventilation system. So should we have reasonably anticipated that someone would do so? And if so, what action should we have taken? I think that what would be more appropriate is looking at whether or not there's any duty to render aid or some assistance. And that—
Well, exactly. And what's your answer to that question? Was there a duty to render aid, or could Ala Moana simply have backed off and just stood there?
Well, I would like to just remind the court, we didn't just back off.
I totally understand.
Despite what Mr. Green has suggested.
The case was decided on a matter of duty, correct? On whether it was reasonable what Ala Moana did.
Exactly.
So what is the duty, or what's your position with regard to the duty of Ala Moana to either summon aid or render aid once it knew she was in the ductwork?
Okay. All right. We start with the general proposition recognizing Lee versus Corregidor and the statement 314, which says that there is no duty to render aid to someone with whom you have no special relationship. No duty to render aid or even summon aid. That's what our courts have recognized so far. Was there a special relationship? In contrast to Mr. Green's view of the case, we don't believe that there's any evidence that Ms. Fry was a business invitee at all.
314A says, a possessor of land who holds it open to the public is under a similar duty, the duty to protect against unreasonable risk of physical harm and to give first aid. Those are the duties. A possessor of land who holds it open to the public is under a duty to protect against unreasonable risk of harm or to give first aid to members of the public who enter in response to his invitation. It doesn't say to reasonably anticipate. Are you saying that you have no duty that if someone, let's say a child who enters an area that is not usually open but happens to be open at that time, you have no duty to that child?
You know, I'm not sure that I can answer the question specifically based on what you've told me, but I would say this, that under Hawaii law, we have had cases that have resulted in pretty harsh results. Doe versus Grosvenor Properties, for example, which in that case, the Supreme Court decided that it was not going to recognize the broad public invitee definition under the restatement and instead referred to the business invitee portion of the restatement. And that says a person invited to enter or remain on land for a purpose directly or incorrectly.
What were the facts of Doe? Was that a third party crime case? Wasn't that the rape?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Right. So we're talking about a third-party crime, right? We're not talking about a third-party crime in this situation, right?
I understand the distinction, Your Honor, but what I'm trying to make the point is that we have established in our case law the recognition that under 314A, we are going to extend that duty to a landowner only with respect to business invitees. It doesn't apply to public invitees. That is our existing case law.
Are you saying that people that go to Ala Moana Center are not business invitees?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay.
I'm not saying that. I am saying that, as compared to Mr. Green, that not every space at Ala Moana is a space.
So please answer my question then. What if a child enters an area that they're not supposed to be in? Are you saying that no duty to that child?
I'm saying that perhaps the case law would support that.
How do you distinguish this case with a person who may have been mentally incompetent at the time?
I cannot. I think that that is the possible outcome of this case. I would say, however, for that becomes the driving force for how the court rules or determines this, that this is a very unique and unusual circumstance. And it seems as if we have a body of law that that relates to premises liability that's pretty well developed, and we also have the legislative intent enacted behind the Good Samaritan statutes, 663.1.5 and 663.1.6. And we want to encourage, the legislative intent says, let's encourage people to help. Let's encourage them to render aid.
Mr. Benedict, would the question of whether someone was a business invitee be a fact question, or could it be a fact question?
Under circumstances other than this case, yes. Not in this case.
What would be different about this case? Almona Shopping Center is almost a town unto itself. I'm not sure if it still has a post office. It has all the amenities that you would find, say, in a town square, whatever. So that I'm not sure why someone who enters on that premises, and I think someone quoted authority out of Oregon that says, when you open the premises to the public for business purposes, you expect to benefit in some way, even if the person doesn't purchase anything on the premises. So I'm not sure how someone who enters on the premises therefore loses the status of business invitee simply because they may not be in a place that's not open to the general public, where the people who go onto the premises.
Your Honor, several points. The first is the case that you're referring to is called Walsh. It's from Oregon, and it relies on the public invitee definition from the restatement, which this court has specifically rejected.
You just read the restatement portion that you say we adopted.
Right.
Where whether the purpose is directly or indirectly related to the business, a business purpose,
right.
we treat those persons as being business invitees.
Right. And I would also point out that with respect to 314A, which is what we use to create the special relationship, the restatement provision, I think it's comment C, notes the fact that someone can lose its status as a, let me double check, I see you all writing, makes me nervous, that someone can lose their status as an invitee, and that's exactly what we're talking about.
Is that a question of fact?
Is a question of fact whether or not Ms.
Yes, was a business invitee. She's on the premises. She may be on the rooftop, but she got there somewhere. I suppose she traveled there after she got on the premises. So should it be left to the jury to infer what her purpose was when she came onto the premises?
No. And I would say the reason is this. What we know, what we have uncontroverted evidence is that Ms. Fry said that she was authorized to be there. Ms. Fry told our people that I was hired by a guy named Joe to clean the exhaust fan. And then we know that she tried to break in and did in fact break into the ventilation system. That is the only admissible evidence of her purpose there. That's it. The other evidence from her, the other evidence is that she was in fact not authorized to be there. We've established through the admissible evidence in summary judgment that we contacted the owners of the two restaurants and verified that in fact she was not hired by anyone.
All right, let's assume you get over 314A duties. How do you get over the section 338, a possessor of land who is in immediate control of a force and knows or has reason to know of the presence of trespassers in dangerous proximity to it, the force being the stoves, the smoke, the heat?
Right, Your Honor. I don't have
assuming that. She was a trespasser.
Right. I don't have that provision in front of me. My recollection is that, well, for one, it talks about the dangerous proximity to it. The way, this takes a little bit of explanation. Plaintiffs do this a little bit differently and for more of a dramatic effect. But remember that the reason why our people went to the roof in the first place is because the exhaust fans were not working. So down in these two food court.
I understand, but at the point she entered and you knew she was in the duct, and you knew that the duct was a smoke duct with ovens, and there was no instruction given until, what, 40 minutes later to turn off the stoves?
That's
or how long was it?
It was from 2:42.
No, turn off the stove from the time she entered, because she entered
about
2:10?
No, that's not even close.
Oh, I thought she entered within a few minutes after Mr. Oshiro got there at 5 or 10. He said 5 or 10 after 2 he got there, right? And within a few minutes, she was inside.
That's not clear.
Okay.
But that is, I will say that is what the plaintiffs attempted to do. And let me show you how they did it in asking their questions. Mr. Oshiro was interviewed right after the accident by Detective Roland Takasato. And he was asked, when did you go to the roof? He said, and it's in the moving papers, I got there about 3 minutes before, 2 or 3 minutes before 2:33, which is what I noticed on the dispatch clock.
At some point, he said 5 or 10 minutes after 2 p.m.
Yes, he did, and let me tell you what he did. Mr. Briner asked him a question, and he said, on that Saturday, a year and a half later, he says to Mr. Oshiro, on that Saturday, about when roughly did you get up to the roof? And Mr. Oshiro said 2:10, something like that. And then from that, the plaintiffs start their timeline. That's the full extent of the evidence that the plaintiffs point to.
But this is a motion for summary judgment.
It is, Your Honor. But there is other timestamp information that makes that evidence unreasonable. For example, Mr. Oshiro's deposition, which is in the record, establishes that he was in the food court restaurants when the fire alarm went off at one of the restaurants. There's a timestamp in the log about that going off at 2:12, 2:13. So on the one hand, we have computerized alarm going off with a timestamp and a notation in the log, and then a witness's rough estimate years later. That's not the kind of stuff that is a reasonable interpretation of the evidence. And certainly not.
But these are really issues about whether it was reasonable or not. Are we losing sight of the question of whether there was a duty? Would Alamoana concede that once it knew she was in the ductwork, that it had a duty to get the stoves turned off?
I think, Your Honor, it's we struggle with that because, to be honest, we would like to say, yes, there was a duty, because that seems like the most humane thing to say, frankly. But in reality, under the law, we can't find an existing duty to act.
The immediate control of a force under Section 338, are you saying that the stove with the heat and the exhaust is not a force that could cause harm to a person?
Yeah. I would not say that it's not a force that could cause harm. We don't view it as a force, per se, but I understand your point. Let me, if I could, Your Honor, just give a little bit more information about this. When they talk about the stoves being on, if you look closely at what they're talking about, it appears they're talking about the pilot light being on. And those of us who are old enough to have had gas stoves with pilot lights, we know that that doesn't mean that anything a heat is being generated from.
I'm sorry, Lobendom, officer, your security officer said one stove Eva where the female was located had 4 ports or pots with hot water. Second stove directly under the female had 2 large cooking woks that had nothing in it. We had the employees of Cafe Siam remove cooking items out of the way and turn off all stoves and gases. And she was surprised when she after she went up and came back down, that the stoves were still on and cooking was still being done. Doesn't that create a genuine issue of material fact?
Your Honor, if I'm understanding the evidence correctly that you just described, you're talking about a stove, EVA, of where Ms. Fry was, not one that was actually in connected to this range hood, and then the one that she was actually under was not on?
And Officer Bagood also recalled that the stoves and ovens at Poibu were still on when he arrived back downstairs.
Yes, and that's what he says. We can't tell from what he says whether or not he's talking about the pilot light or anything being cooked.
Doesn't that create a genuine issue of material fact? He and Lobendon said that the stoves were still on, and she recalls woks being on and cooking being done.
I don't think she said there was cooking being done in the woks, but be that as it may, if the court is inclined to decide that there is a duty to do something after we had to do this, then this issue of whether or not there was stoves on or not is the one issue that I would say there's some question. So that's as far as I can say that. There is contrary evidence, very compelling contrary evidence.
On a motion for summary judgment, the appellate court must also review the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and we also review motions for summary judgment. De novo, correct?
Understood, yes.
Let me just make sure I just understood what you just said. If I understood you were saying if there's an issue here, it would only be with regard to the stove, so it's Alamoana's position there was no duty to promptly summon aid?
Our position is that we cannot find a duty at law to summon aid.
Are you saying that if a child entered a freezer, and for some reason you couldn't open it from the outside, you have no duty to call for aid to open that freezer that child out?
In that case, Your Honor, there is actually restatement provisions that provide guidance, and there would be a duty under that circumstance. But to answer Justice Breckenwald's question, is a two-step analysis, Your Honor. The first is whether or not there is a duty. The second is whether or not actions taken in rendering aid are immunized from liability under the Good Samaritan statute, and we would suggest that they are.
Immunized or subject to a higher burden of proof?
To be technically correct, I would say that that's correct, subject to a higher burden of proof.
Are you talking 61.5 or 1.6?
Under the circumstances that the plaintiffs have suggested, it could be either.
All right, but 1.6 relates to third-party crimes, right?
Yes, it does.
And in this case, it's 663.1.5, any person who in good faith renders emergency care, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And isn't the issue of whether or not emergency care was actually rendered?
No, I don't think that's the issue, Your Honor. I think any emergency care is covered. Emergency care is not defined under the statute. The policy behind the statute is to make sure that we have people attempt to render aid. We think about why we have those statutes. We want to encourage people to do something. And what the plaintiffs are trying to do here is completely contrary to that public policy. They're trying to say, hey, you didn't do this fast enough. You should have done a better job under the unusual circumstances. And therefore, we're going to hold you liable in complete contravention of the policy behind the Good Samaritan statute.
Yeah, but that goes to questions of fact, right? Whether you are fast enough or not fast enough. So if you end up at trial and the jury believes you did everything that was reasonably possible, then you would prevail, right?
If we ended up at trial, yes, that would be the
circumstance. The argument made by the plaintiff is that...
Go ahead.
Sorry? Go
ahead. I thought about what you asked me, and I would say that if we went to trial in this case, we would be entitled to the Good Samaritan instruction, most likely. And
that was my next question to you. How do you reconcile this Good Samaritan law with the law that imposes burdens on a landowner or possessor of land? Would they be contradictory?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the Moyle decision sort of brings that to the
Moyle court. Went to the requirement that in a criminal case, whoever is there should do something to render aid or call the police. That's not this situation.
We with all respect, Your Honor, the plaintiffs had sometimes suggested that this was a criminal act, someone, I mean, it's all over the place. So
okay.
It could.
All right. All right. So even in that instance, would there be some issue with respect to which might control, whatever the landowner's duty would be versus what the statute says?
I don't believe there would be, if I could explain. I believe that when we talk about the landowner's duties, we're talking about primarily the Pickard duty. When we're talking about whether or not the landowner is part or entitled to the protections of 663.1.5, the Moyle decision established that those statutes, when they talk about any person, like 1.5 does, that includes entities like Ala Moana. They're entitled to those protections. So the legislature has said we're going to extend those to any person. It didn't say natural person, it said person. So those protections, by the legislative intent, exists for Ala Moana as well. So to the extent that you're talking about, well, what about the Pickard duty versus the Good Samaritan duty, I actually see them as distinct. And this is an area that is difficult to parcel out. We wouldn't dispute that for a moment. But Pickard, as far as we can tell, has always been applied in Hawaii with respect to the situation of a hazardous condition on the property that the landowner had notice of and was held responsible to correct in the situation where someone was reasonably anticipated to be there. In this case, that's not really what we're really talking about. We're talking about the affirmative act of rendering aid to somebody else who has put themselves in jeopardy. And we don't have an analogous case in Hawaii that relates to this. And it's this very small puka in our law that we have not occupied, we have not built. And based on where...
Well, is there an issue of fact as to whether the plaintiff herself or the decedent put herself in harm's way? If, as the facts show, you can only get to that roof through that lock gate and that latch or hatch, and there was no way for her to get off the roof through those entryways.
No, Your Honor, because as you may remember, Mr. Oshiro opened the hatch and spoke to her. She could have left at that point. She could have called
the latch. The hatch was not locked.
No. So Mr. Oshiro goes through the gate, goes through the hatch, comes up on the roof, and discovers Ms. Fry in the roof. And he asks her what she's doing there. She impersonates a contractor licensed to be there or authorized to be there. She could have left at that point.
Oh, you mean at that point, but not before that. Yourself.
Not before that point. No, that's true.
So she was locked in any fact.
She was locked in. That's true. My time is almost up. I would just like to leave you with this thought. We have summary judgment for a purpose, and I understand Justice McKenna's concerns about not determining facts on summary judgment and what the court's obligation is under those circumstances. But as I look at this panel, I recognize people who have sat as trial court judges or tried to make these arguments and have dealt with what happens if you go to trial and you don't get through, are not successful in summary judgment. I ask the court to think about what this would be at trial. If you look at what the plaintiffs have suggested, they have come up with all sorts of alternative theories. She was locked up on the roof by someone at Ala Moana. She was accidentally locked on the roof. She was invited on the roof. If we went to trial in this case, Ala Moana would be defending against the boogeyman, and we would be put in the place of trying to disprove something that is conjecture. That's not what trials are supposed to be. Summary judgment is supposed to weed out cases like this. And to the extent that Mr. Green would like to say, well, I want to get to trial so that the jury can decide if there's a duty here. The fact of the matter is that that's a court decision. Duty is a question of law, and it's one that we ask you to carefully consider under these circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Mr. Green, your rebuttal.
Sitting here and listening to the questions and answers, the noise in my head is, we lost this case because it was decided as a matter of law. There were no genuine issues of material fact. Unique circumstances, he calls it. In the light most favorable to us, there is no way in the world this case should go out as a matter of law. When Jasmine says to maintenance, I'm authorized to be here, running around barefoot in a pedeo in a sports bar. Well, you know what? If she says it, then she's not a trespasser, is she? If it was true, she's an invitee of Ala Moana to be on the roof to repair whatever she says she's going to repair. Her first words are, what are you doing here? And she says, Joe told me to repair the ventilation system. Well, if it was true, then she's a business invitee or a licensee. She's there for the purpose of serving Ala Moana. But right after that, she's talking about a baby stuck in the vent. One of the things I didn't want to abandon, and very smart lawyer, argues very well, but everything he said about what this case would be at trial walks right into racism's law. We argued that it was rejected by the court, but how they rejected it was on the third element. The doctrine of res ipsa loquitur is not invoked, if the injury was due to the voluntary action or contribution of the plaintiff. That's the law. When we use the word voluntary action or contribution, do we not get into her physical and mental condition at the time she was on that roof? I mean, there's a lot more we would like to do in discovery from experts regarding hypothermia, how she was acting. They admit she seemed confused. She's dirty, she's dusty, she has clothes hidden in ventilation portions of the roof. This walks right into Ray Simpson based on what he says. Very confusing. I mean, if Jasmine was here, I could get some answers. But we don't know, and that's why we have res ipsa loquitur. The only way we lose on res ipsa loquitur respectfully is if the court, and it's certainly factual, for some prior fact to decide whether or not she was responsible for her own injury by voluntarily doing something. And that clearly has got to be a fact issue. For someone to say, as a matter of law, we know her injury was due because she voluntarily acted or contributed to her own injury.
Mr. Green, she jumped into the duct herself. You're not saying that Mr. O'Sherrill forced her in. There's no evidence that somebody pushed her in.
Was she going after the baby? The baby that she said was stuck in the vent?
Does that make it less voluntary?
It depends on her state of mind at the time. It depends on what the experts and doctors say about hypothermia. They've already opined about 90 degrees up there running around barefoot. All I know is that experts can tell us cause and effect. When you have someone that's acting in a bizarre fashion, no one believes there was a baby in there except her. Because she said it. She said Joe sent her up there. And then she's trying to get into the vent. That has to be a trier of fact has to have the opportunity to determine by a preponderance of the evidence where the truth lies and what her mental condition was at the time to say, you know what, she knew she was going into the vent. She wanted to go into the vent and disappear. That's really bizarre. But if you couple that with the comment, as I said, about Joe sent me, or there's a baby stuck in there, there's a reason why. There's no drugs or alcohol involved in this case. I mean, we have the toxicology reports. There's no issue about that. This woman wasn't high on anything. She was just pregnant and young and attractive, and she was locked on the roof. And this thing about calling emergency services? 18 minutes. And then when they called them off and said, we got her out. This is a Three Stooges act with the largest shopping center in the country. You don't have to come anymore because we got her out. And she's still begging to get out. And then they say, no, you better come back again. Jaws of Life gets her out, and she's still alive on the way to the hospital. We're not a third world country. Respectfully, justices, whatever you decide, we cannot allow situations like this or what Justice McKenna suggested about people who are invitees walking into a place that is potentially dangerous and saying, you know what, that's your problem. We got other things to do. Can you maybe sweep up the hall over there or make sure that one of our customers finds their way to the bathroom? That's not what we're about. It's not what we're about. And I appreciate, I'm not being condescending, Justice, when you say that she voluntarily go in there. I believe she didn't, but I believe that it's a fact issue as to whether she did, whether she knew she was going into a ventilation system, whether she appreciated she was going in there, why she went in there, what she was trying to do in there. Because if she went in right after she said there's a baby in there, I'll answer anything else if I can.
No further questions.
Let me just say it's really truly an honor to be before you. I haven't been excited like this in a long time. I'm happy to see all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much to counsel for both Ala Moana and the plaintiffs. This court will take this matter under advisement.